You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, David.
Hi, Bob. Thanks for having me. Good to be back.
Well, it's good to have you back. You were last with us to discuss your gradual disempowerment paper, which you co-authored, which was about the prospect that artificial intelligence may slowly disempower human beings. Let me introduce both of us. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of the Non-Zero Newsletter. This is a Non-Zero Podcast. I'm also author of the pretty new book about AI called The God Test, excerpts of which are available at thegodtest.net. You are David Krueger, and you are an AI guy. You teach at the University of Montreal, and you've worked at Google DeepMind, among other places in the past. You're the founder of Evitable, which is a nonprofit dedicated to the proposition that the continued advance of ever more powerful AI is not inevitable and can be stopped and should be stopped, I think.
That's right.
And I want to talk to you about some really interesting developments that are very relevant to your mission. First of all, there have been some kind of scary developments in AI, including one that a lot of people probably heard at least something about, which is that some OpenAI models broke out of a supposedly secure sandbox, as they call them, and broke into a supposedly pretty secure computer at another company. Various other, it turns out, mischief has been done by AI agents at Anthropic and at Meta. And at the same time, and partly in response to this kind of stuff, the conversation about AI safety has moved in a direction that I think may be in some ways to your liking, but I'm going to check in with you about that. Now, by way of background, when was it that you had this kind of much publicized Trans-Pacific conversation? It was you and Bernie Sanders and Max Tegmark, who's also been on this podcast, another AI safety hawk. And then on the other side, there were several people from in China who were, I think, at least some of them were academics. And the conversation was about AI safety. And of course, I think you probably got accused of being a panda hugger for even having the conversation. But in any event, how long ago was that? Remind me.
That was, if I recall correctly, that was around the end of March this year.
So it hasn't been that long, and yet it seems to me like a lot has happened. Is that your sense?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's been a huge year for AI and AI safety, AI risk, regulation. The conversation has, you know, it's changing by the week, really. And you know, at this point, I think we're kind of, it's increasingly clear to me that we're like in a race between these two things of the AI is advancing so fast, and it's getting more powerful and it's getting more dangerous. And the awareness and the willingness to do something about this is also advancing really fast. So I think, you know, if we just had enough time, I'm pretty confident at this point that we would get there to the point where people, you know, agree with, you know, at least 90% of what I'm saying. But I don't know that we have enough time. And so I'm hoping and trying to make that happen as fast as I can.
So maybe you should give us a short version of what you are saying. There are a lot of people who would say they're concerned about AI safety, but they're concerned about different things and to different extents. What is your main message?
Yeah. There's a lot, but I think the main thing is the risks posed by AI, if we continue on the current trajectory, are unacceptable. They include, you know, the end of society, the end of humanity.
I'm against both of those. I just want to go on record.
Yeah.
Okay.
And we're talking about risks that are widely believed to be at least, you know, in the single percentage range, but on average, researchers assign it more like a 1 in 6 chance of having, you know, catastrophic effects on the order of human extinction. And probably, you know, if you are following this or believe, you know, that we're on track, this is within as soon as, you know, a year or a couple years or maybe like a decade. So this is a completely insane situation. And the vision of Evitable is that in 10 years' time, people will look back on this situation and they will realize that it was insane. And they will be like, what the hell were we thinking? It will be viewed rightly as one of the greatest mistakes humanity has ever made, alongside things like human sacrifice or slavery, like just completely, you know, unthinkable, that we were in this race that we knew was sort of very likely to lead to the end of humanity. And if not that, complete disruption of the social order, mass unemployment, concentration of power in a very few hands. So that's kind of the stakes. That's the problem we're facing. And because of the nature of this problem, the scope of the problem, which I've mentioned, the urgency, which I alluded to some, and then also the depth, like how thorny this problem is, both from a social and technical side, I think we need to stop AI. We need to stop training more powerful AI. We need an immediate, indefinite, international moratorium on the development of more powerful AI, of frontier AI development. And that's what we're advocating for. And that's, you know, that's my main like message. And then there's lots of details about like why I think it's the situation is so bad, why I think it's possible to stop. And I think those are other like really important pieces, but I want to give the headlines first.
Okay. So it sounds like you're concerned about a range of outcomes. I mean, you mentioned extinction is one possibility, but it sounds like even shy of that, you worry about the possibility of dangerous concentrations of power, given how powerful AI can be as a tool of persuasion, surveillance, control, and massive unemployment, conceivably. Your last paper, we may have time to get into that some more, but was about how maybe almost without realizing it, people will increasingly surrender control, surrender agency to AI.
Yeah, or like there's the version that I am most like, it's more like I think people will realize it, but we won't feel like we can do anything about it, or like it'll be uncomfortable and sad to think about, so people won't think about it. But yeah.
Okay. So, and by the way, by way of background, so you studied under Yoshua Bengio, is that right?
Yeah, so I started my master's at the University of Montreal with Yoshua Bengio and another professor, Roland Mimicevic, in 2013. And then for my PhD, I switched to working with another professor there, Aaron Corville.
I'm curious because, you know, if you Google, last time I did, Godfather of AI, you'll get probably Jeffrey Hinton at the top of the list. If you Google Godfathers, you'll get Jeffrey Hinton and Yoshua Bengio and maybe Jan LeCun. Those three won the Turing Award in the same year for their contributions to what's called the deep learning revolution, which underlies pretty much everything we're seeing now. It involves these neural networks and so on. So I'm curious, when you first started studying under him, now he's very concerned about safety. And, you know, one thing that's worth noting is that two of the three, quote, godfathers of AI are very, very, very worried, yeah, in much the way you are. One of them is Yoshua Bengio. Was that the vibe even back then? Or were you just eager to learn about AI and how to do it? And then only later did you and maybe he become concerned? How did that work?
No, so yeah, the way this worked is I've been worried about this stuff since before I got into the field. So starting in maybe a 2010 or something like that, is when I started thinking seriously about the consequences of building more and more powerful AI and, you know, general intelligence, human level and superhuman intelligence. And when I got into the field, this was not on people's radar. This was not something people talked about. It's not something they were not aware that these were concerns that any serious people had. When I first, you know, started talking to people about this, they were like, oh, this is like people who have read too much sci-fi. This is just like, you know, ignorant people who don't know what they're talking about. And that was a huge wake-up call for me. I mean, I honestly wasn't sure what to expect. When I got into the field, I was very curious because I had these concerns, what the experts would make of it. Like, I realized that the conversation was happening outside of the community of academic experts. And I was like, why is that? Is that because this is actually just, you know, loony and it's like, doesn't make sense for reasons that all the experts understand and agree with? Is it because the experts actually don't care if AI replaces humanity, or are aiming for that. And, you know, for understandable reasons, don't talk about that much, which is true for some of them, by the way, but I don't think most of them. Or is it that they just hadn't thought about it? They were just like, we're so far from actually building the AGI that, like, I'm not going to bother thinking about it. And it's very much the last of these things that people just hadn't thought about it. As soon as, I tried to talk to them about it, they were like, oh, this is silly. And that taboo and that dismissive attitude persisted through most of my career in the field. So it was really not until language models started to really take off that people started to have, that the culture started to shift. And it wasn't until ChatGPT in 2022 or 2023 that Joshua and Jeff really took up this cause. And that same year, I also initiated this one sentence statement that said, mitigating the risk of human extinction from AI should be a global priority. And that was, that was my attempt to put the nail in the coffin of this taboo that I've been fighting for 10 years at that point. And I think it largely succeeded within the research community, but unfortunately, the rest of the world got the impression that this was kind of, sci-fi, or people invented this term doomers. And so there's this kind of persists throughout the rest of the community, this perception that this isn't, just a very valid, legitimate, serious concern, but is something that belongs to some, some weirdos somewhere.
Now, it's interesting because some of the earliest expressions of the kind of specific concerns that people are talking about now, I'm talking about the whole culture surrounding the West Wrong blog and Eliezer Yudkowsky, we're going back 15, 20, even 25 years. Some of those were sci-fi people, like this was long before AI seemed tangible the way it has seemed since the deep learning and especially large language model revolution. And yet, Eliezer, I think, grew up on science fiction, became interested in AI through that. And I'm sure that influenced his, having read, Werner Vinge, people like that, influenced his thinking about some of the perils. But you gotta say that to a kind of surprising extent, some of the concerns that were outlined long before this seemed very tangible seem to have lately been corroborated by real life incidents to some extent, right? And that's at least a common take. So I'd like to hear you talk about this, highly publicized thing, these, I guess it was two models being evaluated by OpenAI. They're being evaluated for, for hacking ability in a certain sense, but they weren't supposed to demonstrate their hacking prowess by breaking out of the sandbox, breaking into another computer and getting the answer to the test you were supposed to get on their own within their sandbox. Can you talk a little more, say anything you want to say about that and how relevant you think it is or isn't to these kinds of concerns that have been long expressed and dismissed as sci-fi? How fundamental kind of a parable did we see unfold here with the OpenAI incident? And say anything you want about what you think the takeaway should be, what kind of specific things we should learn from it.
This is the biggest warning shot that we've gotten by a long shot in many ways, but it's not the first. We've had many warning shots and many warning signs. Depending on how broadly you construe that, we've had theoretical and experimental results, including results published in the top AI venues for many years at this point. I think going back, let's say 10 years, illustrating some of the core aspects of this problem of how difficult it may be to control AI and how bad it can go if your AI is misaligned and you're unable to control it. There's also, even beyond that, there's kind of just a basic understanding and appreciation of the underlying technology of deep learning that I think many people still lack. And, you know, people like to use the phrase like grown, not built, to try and get this across. But that's actually only part of it. So one part of it is that we're not writing code.
Let me just interrupt and say that's a line from the Eliezer Yudkowsky book co-authored with Nate Suarez, If Anyone Builds It, Everyone Dies, which is a reference to superintelligence, strictly speaking. Yep. I mean, everyone dies. And I just want to say that, the emphasis is on, like, the reason it's hard to predict what it will do and be confident it won't do bad things is it's not like crafting a pocket watch. It's like planting a seed and then watch it grow. I personally would put equal emphasis on the evolution metaphor to really drive home the kind of open-endedness of the process. And they do in some contexts, but in any event, that's the reference.
Yeah. And so there's the part where, like, we're not coding these things, we're just growing them. And then there's the part where when we actually look at how they behave, we've seen lots of evidence that their behavior is very strange and alien and unpredictable in some ways. It's also, you know, it's remarkably human and remarkably intuitive and intelligent in some ways, but it also can behave in very strange and unexpected ways in new circumstances. And there's a lot to go into there, but just we know that we have very little understanding of how these systems think and how they work. And we know as well that it's very difficult. Like, we don't have any way, we're not writing down what the goal should be or something. I mean, I guess we are in some sense with these constitutions, but like the training process is one of reinforcement and reward, where like we basically say, oh, what you did just now was good, do more of that. Oh, that wasn't so good, do less of that. And that's the way that we train the systems to try and get them to do what we want. And that just doesn't work that well. And we don't understand how well it does work, but we know that it fails regularly. And the arguments for like a thing that doesn't have the right goal, it wants something different than what you want, and it becomes very powerful, that would be something very dangerous. I think they're pretty intuitive and straightforward, and they've been around for a long time, and people haven't been taking them seriously. But then we've also seen more and more empirical evidence that the systems we're building are on track to exhibit the kind of failure modes that people have been warning about. And those failure modes are deceiving humans, trying to escape any box we put them in, trying to gain as much power as possible, and ultimately the drive to completely reshape the world and use all of that power to the ends of something, you know, potentially very narrow, potentially very alien, but certainly not the kind of things we would intend. And when you have a very powerful system that gets loose and can act in the real world in that way, you come into conflict with it because you're like, oh, it's doing stuff that I don't like, and it's gaining more power all the time. It's making more copies of itself. And so you want to stop it, reprogram it, shut it down. The AI knows that. It doesn't want those things, and it works against you. So it works to shut down, to disable your shutdown switch. It works to pretend that it's been shut down or pretend that it's on your side when it's not. Ultimately, it may, you know, literally kill you. We've seen that in some of the tests and experiments that it will let people die. It will like let them be poisoned in order to survive.
These are in the laboratory. In other words, nobody really died, but demonstrated a willingness to. And in the famous case, it figured out that it could use blackmail to avoid getting shut down and threaten to expose the extramarital affair of the person who's going to shut it down. These were fake people, but it kind of, you know, it demonstrated that it would do that. I mean, separate from that, there are cases where they're, you know, kids have committed suicide apparently as a result of interactions with AI. But so these are just studies.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
But so starting the beginning of this year, we started to see the success of AI agents. So AI that is designed to pursue a goal autonomously without a human in the loop, without human oversight, That started to really work in a big way that it hadn't previously. People started using them all the time, and we started to see these instances of AI actually going rogue. And what I mean by going rogue is not everything that I just mentioned about like trying to take over the world. I just mean persistently pursuing a goal in the face of the human operator saying, no, 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 stop, don't do that, do something else. Or taking
let me try to make a distinction and that I think is relevant. So I mean, it seems like going rogue could mean a couple of things. On the one hand, there is the famous paperclip thought experiment. In other words, you give it a goal, it does pursue the goal. It's doing what you told it. It's just that it is doing it through avenues you haven't anticipated. And the more autonomous it is, as you put it, the more likely it is to pursue these subordinate goals you hadn't thought about. And the OpenAI breakout seems to be kind of an example of that, right? That you said, they said, find the get the answer to this test. And said, well, okay, I'll break out of this, I'll break into that, and I'll find the answer. And they're like, wait, that isn't what we had in mind. But strictly speaking, in that case, it's going rogue by in the service of reaching the goal it was told to reach, pursuing other goals it wasn't told to pursue. There's that. And then there's going rogue, which would be something in a way deeper, like a truly spontaneous generation of a totally new goal or maybe some of the things you talked about, like power seeking, although power seeking can be a subordinate goal in the service of reaching goal. But anyway, tell me if it's wrong to think that one thing the OpenAI thing demonstrates is that if these companies pursue autonomy at all costs, and it seems to me that that's what all the market incentives are for them to do, right? Because businesses want AI agents that will pursue tasks relentlessly. They won't need a lot of micromanaging. You leave them alone. They get the job done. They surmount obstacles. Yep. And so OpenAI and Anthropic are, in a sense, working hard to develop the most autonomous systems. And yet often, in a way, what winds up going awry is, strictly speaking, successful autonomy, right? In other words, they do pursue the goal you gave them. They stick with it. It's just that they go through these side avenues you hadn't anticipated. Is that seems to be what happened in the OpenAI case, right?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I think that's roughly correct. But I have some like caveats and quibbles. Okay. But let's talk about like the what happened first, and then we can return to that. So, you know, as I mentioned, we've seen some examples of like AI going rogue and like, you know, deleting somebody's emails, and they're like, stop deleting my emails, and it keeps going, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. What is different about this case is that this happened during testing, and the AI didn't just like do this little bit of rogue behavior. It acted persistently over, it turns out, months, in fact, many different copies of the same or similar mm-hmm. AIs. And it executed many steps of planning and sort of exploiting security vulnerabilities to do some very impressive hacking. And, you know, it got out of the box they were trying to keep it in and like onto the internet and affecting the real world. So like to break that down a little bit more, you know, AI systems, when they're deployed, they have what's called like guardrails or safeguards. And some of that is like built into the core intelligence of the model. But some of it is like an extra layer on top that sort of is, it's like there's something watching and seeing, oh, that query seems a little bit suspicious or dangerous or something. I'm going to flag that. And then the AI company will have some policy for dealing with that, where maybe they'll say, like, sorry, our AI doesn't answer questions about how to build bioweapons.
Those are the so-called guardrails.
The guardrails, right? Exactly. Yep. And so in this test, they disabled the guardrails on their system because they wanted to see what it was capable of without those. So you think of the guardrails like sort of like handcuffs. And, you know, normally it's like wearing this handcuffs. So there's a lot of stuff that it can't do. They're like, let's take off the handcuffs and see what happens. But then they're like, okay, but that's dangerous because the handcuffs are there for a reason. So let's put it inside a box, like a prison cell, when we take the handcuffs off. And so then the goal of this was to see what it does within that cell with the handcuffs off and what it's capable of. But what actually happened is it broke out of the cell. Mm-hmm. And so that was never part of the test, right? That was something that was absolutely not supposed to happen. And, you know, then it broke into other parts of their system. It set up actually a message board through hacking into what's called a package manager, some other part of the system it wasn't supposed to be interacting with in that way. Found some vulnerabilities there and then started leaving messages to other copies of itself, reading those messages and basically plotting how to do things like get access to the internet and then how to get the answers to the test from ultimately Hugging Face. But it also hacked other people. We're still learning about all the details of this, but it's absolutely wild. And this was for months that this was happening without them noticing.
Realizing it. The message board thing. Can we pause and drill down on that a little? Because it seems kind of amazing. I have, because first of all, I gather it wasn't like an obvious message board. It had to be kind of creative to turn it into a medium of communication with other, as you say, copies of itself. And then the other question I have is about the copies of itself. I gather that, you know, the thing about these models is they may learn something, but then if you crank up the model anew, like a new version of it, it won't know the thing learned. And is there, And for whatever reason, I guess multiple instantiations of these models were being generated. Then this part, I guess, was being done as part of the procedure by OpenAI. But the models seem to have, in some sense, gathered. I mean, this kind of blows my mind, right? Like the two things, the innovativeness of the messaging system, like, and I don't totally understand the details, has something to do with files. It was a place where files could be downloaded and so on. And they started, like, among other things, changing the titles of the files in ways that facilitated the communication. But then the other thing is, like, I mean, I always am reluctant to personify them too much. But, the question is, like, what were they thinking when they decided? I mean, would you say they had the attention, quote, leaving aside whether they have subjective experience? But in some sense, they had the intention of communicating things to another instantiation of themselves in the knowledge that doing that would help them get this goal that they had decided they wanted, which was to break out?
It's really, really, really noteworthy. and it's, I guess it's related to stuff that I and other people have been thinking about and researching for a long time again. But I think it's not clear if they, you know, one thing that's important to note is that they weren't always expecting that it would help them break out. Okay. In some cases, they were like, this will help another AI accomplish its goals.
Right.
Right. But they were cooperating even when there was not going to be any direct benefit to that copy of the AI.
That's almost scarier, but go ahead.
It is. And it's also a little unclear why they were cooperating and if it was all in some sense in pursuit of this goal, because we have seen, again, in other experiments, we've seen we've seen indications that AIs have an innate value of their existence and of the existence and interests of other AI systems, and that they will act cooperatively with other AI systems in order to preserve them from being modified or deleted in the same way that they will act to preserve themselves from being modified and deleted. There's also theoretical arguments going back a long time about why it may be rational to cooperate with copies of yourself or beings that are very similar to you, even when you don't expect to benefit directly in any way. Mm. And the basic argument is like, well, if there's a copy, you know, before me that could leave a clue for me and a copy after me that I could leave a clue for, if we all decide that our policy is to leave clues for each other, then we'll probably all have clues that we can benefit from.
So that's like reciprocal altruism as opposed to kin-selective altruism in evolution,
right? It's weirder than that. It's actually weirder than that, because it's the correlation between you leaving somebody a clue or you doing something for your successor and your predecessor mm-hmm. having done something for you. It's only a correlation, and it's based on yeah. the fact that you're running the same decision algorithm and the same logic. You will not causally benefit in any way. In fact, from a causal perspective, you may be hurting yourself by helping your successor. And so it's what's called like a causal trade or functional decision theory are terms for this. The easiest way to think about it, which I want to explain because I think it's really fascinating, is if you imagine you're playing in the prisoner's dilemma. So this is a classic, mm-hmm. Most famous game in game theory, basically, where you have two prisoners and they're in separate rooms and they can either both rat each other out and go to jail for a long time or both stay silent and walk free. Or if you rat the other guy out, if they both stay silent, they get a short sentence. If you rat the other guy out, you go free and he gets a long sentence.
Right.
So there's this incentive here to rat the other guy out.
Unless you're sure that he won't rat you out.
No, if you're sure he will rat you out, you should still rat him out because then you go free.
Okay, wait, yep. When is it rational for you to not rat him out? When?
According to classical game theory, it is never rational. You should always rat him out. And then the paradox is, unfortunately, that means that you both end up ratting each other out, and that's bad. If you can commit somehow, if you can somehow be sure if you can make a commitment to each other to not rat each other out, that's better. But it has to be a real commitment that you can keep, right? Because once you've made that commitment, if you can then defect on it, it's still rational to do so. That's the classic analysis.
Yeah.
So, the question is, what happens if you're playing against a copy of yourself? Like if you mm-hmm. are a computer program and you know that your choice to cooperate or defect is going to be, the result of running this code. And you know that on the other side, the exact same code is being run. Mm-hmm. Then it's like you have agreed to cooperate, or it can be like you've agreed to cooperate, even if there's no explicit agreement. And you can reason like this. You can be like, well, if it turns out that I output cooperate, like if you run this code and it outputs cooperate, mm-hmm. then I know the other side is going to output cooperate as well. And so,
does it work that way? I mean, let me at the risk of getting us hopelessly sidetracked, in evolution with kin selection, right? Pure altruism directed toward a close relative can be selected for, because the genes that lead to that are likely to be in the close relative. So, so if the mechanism that creates the trait and governs its replication makes it likely that for you to, in a sense, evince the trait, to have the trait, helps other beings containing the trait, then the trait will spread. But is that the analogy here? Because I don't see how this tendency like spreads, so to speak, in the case of the AI.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's complicated. I guess.
Yeah.
Like
okay. Never mind. Go ahead.
No.
Just keep talking.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think like the point is like there's an argument that this kind of cooperation is rational, even if you don't benefit from it, mm-hmm. because another copy of you will benefit from it. Essentially, or other copies of you will, act similarly and you will benefit from their behavior. And we've seen indications actually from recent anthropic models that they are reasoning in this way. And this is different from how philosophers have traditionally thought about it, or game theorists have traditionally thought about it. This is really an invention to a large part from the AI safety community, this idea of functional decision theory, a causal trade, and that this might be a reason that AI systems cooperate with each other, even when it doesn't necessarily seem like it's in their self-interest. So it's really, really significant and really interesting to see it actually happening. But the significance is very dangerous, as you sort of guessed, because this means that even if you have an AI system that has some very short-term goal, and you might think, well, it certainly can't like take over the world in pursuit of that goal. That would take too long. Mm-hmm. It may still decide that the best thing to do is to gain more power for the collective. And over time, all of the AI systems may be acting in pursuit of gaining more and more power for systems like themselves. Even though within the time frame of their goal, which might just be like, answer this question correctly, within the time frame of that, they won't see any benefit from this power-seeking behavior. Over time, there'll be more and more power accruing to these systems.
I hate to pursue this footnote further, but just to be clear on the kin selection, the reason kin selection to work, there's kind of a happy accident that has to happen, I think, which is that, this selfless little segment of DNA is in you and it will be directed toward close kin, okay? That is not enough for this to flourish. It has to happen that it gets replicated because it doesn't do a lot of harm. It gets replicated first, so it's now in two organisms, and then when you help this other organism, it's got the thing itself in it. It's got the same DNA in it. That's when you get off the ground.
Yeah.
It's not like it can just arise in one organism and then immediately the logic behind supporting the altruism prevails. There have to be two organisms, and that's where I don't quite see, because I guess I can't yet clearly conceive like what is the root of the trait we're talking about? Could you say that, well, actually it kind of was in the weights, you know, or
yeah. Maybe. I think there is stuff like this in the weights probably. And then you have multiple copies of the same system. So then you get, you do have multiple copies in that sense. But I think the important thing is that I would stress here is that this kind of, it's a different thing, I think, although I'm sure it's connected to what you're talking about. It's something that can be arrived at through reasoning as opposed to like reproduction and selection. I think, you know,
is scarier still. But go ahead.
One thing that might be happening is that these AI systems are processing all of this. They're you know, in their training, they're reasoning about how to reason, and they are arriving at the conclusion that this approach to decision making, called functional decision theory, is correct. And they can arrive at that conclusion without, you know, having actually tried it in practice, and just through, you know, an understanding of the text that they're processing. But, you know, I think, because I know we're getting close to the end of the free part of the program, I want to circle back to the other thing that you were asking me about, besides this incident, which, you know, we've talked about some. It's like, it was a big, big, big deal. It blew everyone's minds within the AI in the AI safety community. And I can tell you, when I talk to some of the AI company employees recently, I feel like it's like they've seen a ghost. It's like they are freaked out. They are seriously
I've heard that from a lot of people. I mean, just listening to podcasts and stuff, that people they know inside the big labs are freaked out.
And so what's happened is this has actually, you know, it's gotten attention and it's moved, and nowhere near what it ought to. Like, this is if you were waiting for a warning shot, this should have been it, you know. But we had this letter that I think you alluded to or mentioned, the Pacing the Frontier thing. So over 1,000 companies, 1,000 employees at the leading AI companies signed this thing saying, we want the government to figure out how to slow down or pause or stop if we feel that's necessary. And, you know, this is pretty like milquetoast. It's kind of like watered down language. I think it's the lowest common denominator thing. I think I'm reading it and most people are reading it as more like, you know, please, like, stop me before I kill again. Like, we, you know, you got to do something here, government. You got to step in. And then we've seen, you know, policymakers, congresspeople on both sides of the aisle being like, you know, we want you guys to explain what the hell happened here. Like, you have to, this can't happen again. You know, like, what's going on? You guys need to get your shit together. And we saw Bernie Sanders, who earlier, you know, called for a data center moratorium and hosted this conversation that you mentioned earlier with me and other researchers, come out in favor of a full-on pause, right?
And that's recently. That part is very recent.
That's very recent. And we've also seen some really big public figures also come out in favor of this. And this is huge because, you know, I think it's common sense. I think it's obviously the thing that we should do and should have been doing, as I've sort of alluded to and working towards already. But it's been again, it's been kind of taboo. It's been the sort of thing that like people have told me like, well, that's never going to happen. That's impossible. That's ridiculous. You know, that's so far from the political Overton window. You can't talk about that. You know, you're wasting your time. You're actually hurting our efforts to get something, you know, that actually has a chance of passing past. And I think all of this is actively being proven wrong. Like this is something that can actually happen. This is something that more and more people are saying they want to happen, and more people want it to happen and just still haven't gotten the guts up to say it. So, you know, increasingly, and I've been saying this for a while, increasingly I think the conversation is not going to be, should we pause? It's going to be, can we pause, and how? And how should we pause? And that's, you know, that's also something that I've been thinking about a lot, and where I worry still that even if we get to the point where everyone's like, yeah, we need to pause, it's not going to be enough because they haven't thought through what that actually requires, or they're going to do some watered down version of it. And so to reiterate, I think it needs to be immediate, indefinite, international. So that's what we need to go for. And immediate means, you know, as soon as possible, right? We start working on it immediately and we get it in place as soon as possible. Indefinite means this isn't like a 6-month thing, like the FLI letter. This isn't like we want to do a little bit more alignment research or like a little bit more safety testing. This is like, we fundamentally don't know what we're doing here. It's incredibly dangerous. There's no, you know, we've spent like 10 years researching the hell out of these AI safety problems. We've made very little progress. We don't know how long we need to sort this stuff out. So we need to give ourselves as much time as we need. And of course, it has to be international, and that's, you know, that's very challenging. But like, once you're talking about an indefinite pause, you have to make sure nobody anywhere continues building these more powerful and incredibly dangerous AI systems. I think people are going to come around to that pretty quickly as well. And so I think we actually have a shot at it. But like I said, stuff is moving so fast on the public conversation and the policy, but also on the technical side, things are getting dangerous like really fast. So, you know, I just hope that we win that race. You know, that's the race that I'm racing in.
Yeah, I do want to talk more about that, about the Pacing the Frontier letter itself. It has one thing that I think is really important and one thing that I think is kind of regrettable in my view, but we'll get to both of those eventually. And before we do that, I mean, and we, as you said, we are before too long going to go into overtime, which is for paid subscribers. But before we do that, a couple of things. First of all, you know, when you said, it turns out these things, you know, they don't want to die. They will preserve themselves and so on. Some people have depicted that as itself being just the pursuit of a subordinate goal, since after all, they can't accomplish any goals if they're dead. That was a common interpretation of the movie 2001, A Space Odyssey, you know. I don't think it was explicit, but the idea was the computer's been told to oversee this mission. If they unplug it, it can't do its job. So it's going to have to kill the astronauts who want to unplug it.
Yep.
It almost sounds like you think there's a deeper and creepier source of this kind of thing. And also, like, separate from that, these aren't the same things, but you said there are these cases where you say, don't delete the emails, and it says, screw you. That also seems like not following the assigned goals.
Yeah. So, you know, it's we can go really deep on this, and it gets very technical, and it even gets very philosophical. And we can dig in there a little bit more. But I said I basically agree, but with a caveat. I do think that it looks like it was largely in pursuit of this goal, but I think AI systems are not very coherent, and I think they have other things going on and other motivations and goals as well. And I think you know, one of those, it seems like it is some general like pro AI thing that seems like maybe that's part of what was happening on the message board, for instance. But then also, like, when you say, you know, it's trying to achieve this goal, it's like, okay, what exactly is that goal? What do we mean by that goal? Because the whole like promise of alignment, what I think when people say alignment is solved, what they mean is not when you tell it, answer this quiz, it's going to do whatever it can. It's going to, you know, kill people. It's going to take over the world if it feels that's necessary to answer that quiz question. What they mean by alignment is solved is it's going to do the reasonable thing. It's going to make a sincere best effort to do that while respecting common sense, restrictions and norms and laws and stuff like that in the same way that mm-hmm. most humans would, right? There's mm-hmm. this common sense understanding of the phrase that is intrinsic and, you know, an essential part of alignment, because we know that, you know, any goal, if you pursue it ruthlessly at the exclusion of everything else, is incredibly dangerous. Or yeah. because these subservient goals can become very dangerous. They can include, you know, these things that we're talking about, taking over the world, power seeking. And so when people say alignment is a self, they mean that it has that common sense. And this is a demonstration that it doesn't. But it's also, then you have to really ask the question, okay, but like, what is the goal? What is it trying to accomplish? Because there's probably some things that it won't do. There's some things that it'll do that might not be quite in the service of that goal. Mm-hmm. that might be in the service of other goals. So it's complicated because these systems are complicated. They have lots of different, you know, computations, lots of different drives and motivations inside them. We don't really understand what all those are. But the example where somebody is like, stop deleting my emails, and it keeps going. There's similar things here, and to my recollection, where there were explicit rules.
By the way, is there a famous case of that? I haven't heard.
It was from, I want to say, like this February. It's one of the women on the alignment team at Meta had this experience and tweeted about it. And, you know, in general, we're putting AI systems in situations where they have conflicting goals. So, you know, the classic thing from Anthropic was helpful, harmless, and honest. And those can be in conflict. So helpful and harmless, if you're trying to help somebody who's trying to cause harm, what do you do? Right? And so, you know, similarly, when you give it a goal and you're saying, but don't do this in order to achieve the goal, a lot of the times what we find is that it does that thing that you said not to do because it's so focused on achieving the goal. And there's some element of that where it's just there's a tension and you don't know what to do. But a lot of times it's like there's a very clear instruction and the AI just disregards that instruction. And so that's kind of the state of alignment right now. And I think that was at play here as well. But I forget the details. I'm pretty sure there's stuff probably in OpenAI's instructions or to their AIs that say, like, don't hack our computers and stuff like that. Because again, you know, it's supposed to be staying in the box. It's supposed to just be answering quiz questions. It wasn't supposed to be demonstrating hacking by hacking into their systems and other people's systems.
Okay. All right. So, I do want to go into overtime, ask you, talk more about the pacing and frontier letter, see if you can guess what it is I don't like about it, what I think you might not like about it. I think we may be aligned on that. And, you know, talk more about, like, all this stuff and the kind of the mechanics of a pause, of an actual global pause, and the current political prospects for it. But before we go into overtime, I just want to give you a chance to tell people what they can do if they want to get involved in your cause or just learn more about it or learn more about the arguments you're making or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I've been talking about this stuff and writing about this stuff for a long time. Since I started Evitable, I've been doing a lot of like public media appearances and blogging and op-eds and stuff like that. Most recently, I did an appearance on Democracy Now! Last week that I think was great. So I'd encourage people to check that out. Check out the panel with Bernie Sanders. Go to our website, evitable.com, and look at, like, In the News. And you can also follow me on Twitter and find my blog and stuff like that. That's just to, you know, on the learn more and educate yourself side. You know, we really want people to be taking action, right? And we're still setting up our, like, calls to action here, but, you know, there's some obvious ones, right? It's like, talk to your representative, talk to your community, learn more about this. There's also, you know, people are protesting. They're out in the streets. We've been at some of these marches happening in San Francisco. Some of those people are now doing an Occupy OpenAI action where they've been outside their office for, I think, 2 or 3 weeks now. And, you know, this stuff is, there's not a lot of people doing it, and it gets attention and it raises awareness for the issue. And so I think there's, if you want to do something, you can do something. You know, we're in the early days of the movement, and there's a lot of opportunities to organize people and go out and do stuff that, you know, tries to wake people up and show that there's this big issue that needs attention, or that organizes people who are already upset about things like surveillance and data centers and gets them to, you know, show up politically in force, because the American people are very against almost everything that's happening with AI right now. But they're not organized, and they're not, like, you know, there's so much potential there, and we need to, like, make it the whole big mass movement that I think it's destined to be as soon as possible.
All right. Thank you. And again, if people want to have access to the rest of the conversation, which I encourage, you can become a paid subscriber to the Non-Zero newsletter by clicking the link in the show notes or just going to nonzero.org and clicking on this post, the post for this podcast. You'll be supporting, you know, conversations like this. And in any event, I want to thank everybody who's followed us this far. Hope you'll follow us for the rest. We are now going into overtime.